Yeah. Until next week, this has been The Drive with Michaela. Thank you. Have a good one.
Welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on The Wire today...
Some of the moon rocks that were collected by the Apollo astronauts were in fact parts of the Earth that were blasted off.
We look back at the Apollo 11 launch, what happened on this day 50 years ago. Also on the program tonight...
For us, though, it's an opportunity for humans across the world to actually highlight exploitative practices that are going on in Amazon.
With Amazon holding Prime Day today, several of the company's warehouse workers have gone on strike in protest the alleged poor working conditions. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire. But first, in the desert outside of Tennant Creek in the Northern Territory, a huge array of solar panels are being built. This will be a $20 billion project to supply electricity to Singapore, and the company supplying it is called Sun Cable. I asked the Shadow Minister for Climate Change, International Development and the Pacific and Defence, for the Pacific and also the Department of Defence, Pat Conroy, how big this development was for Australia.
Australia has... The greatest concentration of solar radiation of any continent in the world. So we should be the heart of solar power, and it makes sense for some of our near Asian neighbours to take advantage of the cheap solar power that we can generate to be transported to their nations through underwater high DC cables, where you actually lose very little electricity in transporting them to Singapore or Indonesia. So these projects have been talked about for a long time. It's quite practical if you get the finance together and the customers. So it's not a surprise that we're seeing a strong interest in them.
Well, why haven't we got this electricity going to some of our own places here in Northern Territory and South Australia, say, for instance?
Well, it's a function of the geography and the customer demand. So we've got strong solar radiation in the Northern Territory, Western Queensland, Western New South Wales and Western Victoria, and those final three feed into the national electricity market. But Pilbara and where they're looking at the solar power for Singapore are quite remote areas. So you need a lot of customers to justify it, and places like Singapore, the price of electricity is very expensive, so they're prepared to underwrite the cost of building not only the solar farms, but the long transmission connections you need to get the power to where the customers are.
And what would be the possibilities of getting this sort of array up elsewhere in the country to replace some of our ageing coal-fired power stations?
Well, as I said, it's already happening in Western New South Wales, Western Queensland and...
That's that big one in Western New South Wales that the New South Wales government was talking about.
Yeah. Some of those are happening without any government involvement. But the challenge federally is that a lot of investment's been driven by the renewable energy target, and that target will be met next year. And this government's had something like 15 energy policies in 6 years. So we're going to see investment fall off a cliff, which means we won't be getting extra renewable energy coming into the system to replace our ageing coal-fired power stations that are just breaking down more and more due to their age.
So have you got any plans to bring this up in Parliament when it resumes?
Oh, absolutely. It's something that I and my Labor colleagues talk about consistently. We went to the last election with very strong policies, for example, a $1.1 billion hydrogen plan, a plan to produce batteries in this country, for example, and we'll be keeping the pressure up on the government. This is the start of another industrial revolution, one where Australia is uniquely placed due to our geography, our great solar and wind resources, but we need an activist government who isn't hopelessly divided between those who refuse to accept the science of climate change and those who just can't be bothered taking action. So we'll be placing the pressure on them when Parliament resumes. You can take that to the bank.
Shadow Minister for Climate Change, International Development, the Pacific and also Defence, Pat Conroy, speaking with me there. Well, today marks the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 launch from NASA, and other spacefaring organisations are celebrating around the world. However, by looking back at what happened 50 years ago, Australia's own space agency is looking to the future as well, and how this nation can contribute to the ongoing space race. Kevin Suarez has the report.
Humans have long been fascinated by observing what lies in the skies above. Around 5,000 years ago, the Babylonians observed other nearby celestial bodies. Nearly 500 years ago, Galileo was one of the first people to use a telescope, and he supported the theory that the Earth and other planets revolved around the Sun. And on this day 50 years ago, Apollo 11 left Earth on its way to the Moon.
3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Anthony Murfitt, deputy head of the Australian Space Agency, explained the social impact the moon landing had 50 years on.
The Apollo moon program was an enormous feat of ingenuity. It brought together over 400,000 people to land the first humankind on the moon. I think when people look back at what was achieved through the 1960s, to land someone on a planet beyond Earth was quite remarkable. From the scientific community's perspective, it provided an opportunity for the world to get a greater appreciation of the moon.
Radio astronomer with Macquarie University, Dr. Cormac Purcell, elaborated how the scientific community benefited from the moon landing.
We discovered quite a bit, actually. Some of the most significant things weren't necessarily about the moon itself, but about the Earth. So not many people know, but in fact some of the moon rocks that were collected by the Apollo astronauts were in fact parts of the Earth that were blasted off. So the moon may in fact be a time capsule to tell us a little bit about the geological ages of the Earth and how the Earth was formed.
Not everything is known about the moon. Dr. Purcell says examining the moon for the past 50 years has revealed that the satellite may still hold some secrets.
Well, we did think that it was completely geologically inactive, but in fact, because we've been looking at it for over 50 years now, we can compare old photographs that were taken in preparation for the moon landings to more modern images, and we can see that there is some geology going on. We can see land slippages and little faults that have ruptured open. So we don't quite understand why that is yet, and so we still need to answer questions about the deep geology of the moon.
He says Australia is still a major player in the space industry.
As regards becoming a major player in the space race, we kind of already are. Since the moon landings, Australia has been one of the places that NASA uses in order to keep track of all of the different space missions that are sent to other planets. So specifically the Deep Space Tracking Complex down at Tidbinbilla outside of Canberra is one of their major nodes in the network of radio tracking stations that are used to communicate with all of those spacecraft. As you might know, Australia's just started a new space agency, and that's going to be something that's going to play a larger role for Australia's future.
Mr. Murfitt says the agency knows how Australia will maintain a role within the space industry.
Some of the ways Australia can be involved in the future come from our unique location here on Earth. We have a large continent in the southern hemisphere, which means we have a unique view into the galaxy. That is one of the reasons why Australia played a key role in the moon landing. Looking forward, we also have new technologies such as robotics and automation, which is used in our mining sector. For example, those yellow trucks are all automated. There is the longest autonomous rail in the world of over 1,600 kilometres. And as we look to what can happen in space, that level of automation where it can be controlled from Earth is something that will be needed to support those activities going forward.
Although the moon has only been visited a handful of times, it is still unknown what role it will play in future space exploration. As Dr. Purcell explains, there is still some debate over whether a Mars landing should be prioritised over landing on the Moon again.
Well, the Moon is often considered a staging point to go to Mars. However, it is still difficult to get there. I mean, it's a three-day flight. And Buzz Aldrin has recently been talking that we should skip the Moon altogether and that we should go to Mars. If you want to go to Mars cheaply, one of the thoughts is that you build a base on the Moon or a base around the Moon and use that as a staging point. But in fact, it might actually be cheaper to build a base in low Earth orbit and then go from there instead. So the Moon might be almost a little bit of a distraction.
Dr. Cormac Purcell, astronomer from Macquarie University, ending that report by Kevin Suarez. While customers celebrate Amazon's Prime Day with purchases, warehouse workers around the world are instead opting to protest. Employees in the US, UK, Germany, Spain, and Poland are demanding that the company ease productivity quotas, convert more temporary workers to Amazon employees, and to do more to address on-the-job injuries. Lachlan McPherson has this report.
Now in its fifth year, Amazon's Prime Day is a 48-hour cut-price sale. For the Jeff Bezos-owned company, it's an opportunity to offload stock and to enlist or keep Amazon Prime members. For workers, it is both crunch time and a blackout period, where the unrelenting pace of work is even worse, and where days off, for the workers that receive them, cannot be scheduled. For unions, as mentioned by Emily McMillan, Director of Campaigns at the Transport Workers Union, it's an opportunity to highlight the exploitative practices that are going on in Amazon.
So we've got a culture of fear, of insecurity and constant observation, where we have workers that are forced to run to complete their job, are given KPIs that they can't complete. You have 1 in 10 of them being fired in the US because they're never going to complete these targets. When they do, they're getting injured, they're having chest pain, they're having stress and anxiety conditions.
William Holtz, a worker at the Shakopee warehouse in Minnesota, explained to the BBC that workers just want to be treated with respect as human beings and to not be treated like machines, detailing just how fast Amazon employees and casual workers are required to work.
So I'm an order picker, and so all the merchandise is on these storage pods that robots bring to my station, and I have to pick an item about every 8 seconds, or 332 per hour for a 10-hour day, 40 hours a week for these years. And it's very fast-paced work. I've seen many people in my department have to deal with shoulder injuries, back injuries, knee injuries after, in some cases, less than a year on the job.
Workers in Australia have reported similar conditions, with employees telling Fairfax late last year and ABC News earlier this year that the company has extreme performance indicators, that employees are given a countdown for picking and packing, and that they felt overworked and dehumanized. Their position on unions, though, two of which are leading this global movement, is made quite clear in this training video sent to Whole Foods Market Management in 2018 and leaked by Whole Worker to the media.
We are not anti-union, but we are not neutral either. We do not believe unions are in the best interest of our customers, our shareholders, or most importantly, our associates.
Worldwide, a digital picket line has been formed, with people calling for boycotts on everything Amazon, including Amazon Store, Amazon Prime, Prime Video, Amazon Web Services, Audible, Book Depository, Comixology, Goodreads, IMDb, Kindle, Twitch TV, Washington Post, and Whole Foods Market. Here in Australia, the Transport Workers Union and the Shop Distributive and Allied Employers Association have joined forces to form the Online Retail and Delivery Workers Alliance to look at what practices they want to ensure are protected and what practices they'd like to stop from coming into Australia, with Ms. McMillan of the TWU explaining this further.
Australia's actually a lot newer an entrant in the Amazon space, so they're only more freshly here. So we're at an early phase of our campaign and our work, really at an education point where we're getting in and talking to the workers and working with the SDA to do that. We're at an education phase with the general community just to begin to expose these issues, and we're doing global solidarity with the unions from those countries to assist them with their protests and fight as well and spread the message.
Emily McMillan of the Transport Workers Union, ending that report by Lachlan McPherson. New information obtained by the Lock the Gate Alliance under Freedom of Information laws reveal that Adani has been using aggressive tactics in trying to intimidate scientists tasked with providing ecological reviews to federal and state governments. Rob Osborne has the story.
There have been some dramatic developments in the battle over the future of the Adani coal mine. Documents obtained by the Lock the Gate Alliance reveal interference by Adani in the provision of expert advice to both the federal and state governments. Ellie Smith, Queensland Projects Coordinator for the Lock the Gate Alliance, explains the background to these revelations.
We thought these documents under Freedom of Information, because we have been following the numerous versions of the Groundwater Dependent Ecosystem Management Plan. And when we received these documents, we realised that they included a number of emails back and forth from the Department of Environment and Energy at the federal level, CSIRO and Geosciences Australia, and Adani, with Adani requesting the names of individual scientists who were working on the Groundwater Dependent Ecosystem Management Plan, which we found quite concerning, and so we've passed on to the ABC.
Is it the case that the expert advice was withheld from the Minister, Melissa Price, before she signed off on the groundwater plan?
No, we understand that the federal department did have the documents, but they weren't passed on to the state government until just before that approval was made. So I guess the situation with the Groundwater Dependent Ecosystem Management Plan was that it needed to be approved both at the federal level and the state level, and there were different conditions at each level. So they needed to have different assessments done on them, and it would have made more sense for the state government to have that document as soon as possible so that they could undertake their assessment. But Adani seemed like they didn't want to have that document made public, and so they asked the federal government to keep that document from the state government until the decision was made.
Do you have similar concerns about the process of investigating the impact on the habitat of the black-throated finch?
I think where the process around the black-throated finch comes into relevance with these documents is that Adani used the same tactics that they were trying to use against scientists in Geoscience Australia and CSIRO. Just before or during the period when this was all taking place, they were slamming the scientists that were involved with the black-throated finch analysis. They were leaking information to the media about them, and they were trying to draw a link between them and anti-coal activists, which really put these independent scientists' careers in jeopardy by suggesting that they weren't being impartial and entirely professional in the way that they were undertaking their assessments. So that was just the background to what was happening with Geoscience Australia and CSIRO, and would have caused a lot of angst, I think, for the individuals involved.
What does this Freedom of Information material reveal about Adani's tactics?
Adani has been hell-bent on intimidating and bullying its way into getting its Carmichael mine approved. The company has bullied the Queensland government and journalists and now scientists, and they've been employing these so-called attack dog tactics that their legal team suggested that they should use in order to get these approvals through. Scientists were clearly disturbed to learn that their profiles were being viewed by Adani online, and this is just an unacceptable situation given that the scientists undertaking these assessments need to be totally independent and free of outside influence.
Ellie Smith from the Lock the Gate Alliance, concluding that report from Rob Osborne. I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to The Wire around Australia on the Community Radio Network. The National Indigenous Legal Assistance Service is due for its five-year renewal of funding. Despite a review in March which indicated that the program was achieving its objectives, it appears that their funding is now to be put in with other programs, which would not necessarily guarantee their future. I asked Cheryl Axelby, co-chair of NATSOLS, what she thought was going on.
The Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander, as people as we know, is the most incarcerated mob in the world. And the Indigenous Legal Assistance Program is the only national program dedicated to ending the disadvantage experienced by our mob in the justice system. So there was an independent review into the Indigenous Legal Assistance Program, which was called ILAP, in March. And its number one recommendation was that the government maintain this separate dedicated national program rather than mainstreaming it. So that's the historical context.
Right. So that's just in March.
Yeah, that's in March. And that was a review into the Indigenous Legal Assistance Program, which happened because we're coming to the end of our five-year funding agreements. And the review was to look at whether the Indigenous Legal Assistance Program was of value and was it, you know, delivering what it was supposed to. And the review found that it did. And, you know, as I said, it made the number one recommendation for the Commonwealth Government to maintain it and to continue as a standalone program administered by the Commonwealth. What the proposal is by the Commonwealth is that they want to place Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Services funding into a new national mechanism. And this is yet to be negotiated and agreed to by states and territories and put us all in the same bucket of money, like with just the Legal Aid Commissions and the Community Legal Service Centres. So the challenge, or the issue for us about that, is one that we've had a nearly 50-year commitment from Commonwealth to ensure that there was a separate program that was to address the disadvantage for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people facing the justice system, for which where we receive our funding.
And so what do you do that's different to what Legal Aid would do?
Well, what we do is that first, community controls organisations. We actually have Aboriginal boards. So, you know, when we talk about self-determination and, you know, making decisions in regards to our own organisations, that's really crucial. Number two, we are connected to community in our services. So we provide more than just legal services. We provide advocacy and support. We walk and walk alongside our mob in the justice system. We deal with child protection.
You're a bridge to the greater social services system as well.
Absolutely. And also we highlight the barriers and the impacts of justice and legislation and reforms that impact that drive our mob further into incarceration as well.
Because it's been well documented that the rates of deaths in custody are greatly reduced when there is someone that you can call when you get incarcerated.
That's
you don't know, you know, you're removed from family, friends, your environment where you've had support structures. If there's somewhere where you can call and they allow you to do it, it puts things back on track, doesn't it?
It does. And you know, people. We provide, you know, after our service supports to our community members that are detained by police. You know, in New South Wales, they have a real deadly model there where they have lawyers employed under their custody notification program. So they have lawyers who can actively provide immediate legal advice. Some of us other Aboriginal legal services don't have it run by lawyers, but we've been voluntarily providing after our supports through our Aboriginal field officers to ensure that our agencies are contacted and that they have somebody that can go in immediately and support them when they're taken into custody. But, and we're also the only service providers in a lot of our rural and remote communities, particularly in the bush courts, whereas, you know, the mainstream services do not provide services there.
Cheryl Axelby, co-chair of NATSOL, speaking with me there. And And that's about it for us on The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au, or you can subscribe to our podcast. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for The Wire Radio, all one word. The Wire is a team effort by 4EB in Brisbane, Radio Adelaide in Adelaide, and 2SER 107.3 here in Sydney. And you can hear us on your radio or online across Australia every weekday. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so tune in again then. We'll be coming from Radio Adelaide. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 here in Sydney, and The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation. I'm Roderick Chambers, and thanks for your company.
Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.